Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi.
You remember that song from the 80s? I'm a material girl in a material world. I remember at the time how I found that song, or what it symbolized, a bit disgusting. Although I had to admit there was a bit of self-reflection on the part of the singer to at least admit those qualities. When it was out, that time, I remember how that, for me, symbolized a bit certain elements of a kind of materialist way, a crass way of looking at life, something which really seemed to be devoid of a deeper meaning or devoid of a certain kind of integrity. You know, this idea that really being, placing a lot of value, placing a lot of refuge in that which is more superficial. You know, the glittery aspect of life, and thinking that that's goal, when in fact it seemed to be more devoid of substance. And I remember at the same time, it's about that time that there was a certain type of evangelical spirit was kind of gaining a lot of momentum in the U.S., and it had a lot of emphasis on placing large donations to churches or whatever, and there was a certain, you know, promise or assurance that with the right size donation, you definitely get through the pearly gates. And you find the same thing in Thailand. Unfortunately, there are certain aspects of Thai Buddhism which are modeled a bit on that evangelical model can be quite blatant in the promise of heaven for the right size donation. Now, in Buddhist terms, the whole idea of heaven as a midterm goal in long-term practice of the path of the Dhamma, it's actually a very valid way of looking at practice. It may be realistic that not everybody who's interested in the Dhamma, not all of us, would have enough innate potential to realize full enlightenment in this life. However, with a certain amount of good karma, then aspiring to a heavenly rebirth is not, considering of the various options in samsara, it's not a bad one. It can be like a staging point or a base camp for to gather strength and energy to go further up the mountain. And whether that is seen in terms of an actual state, or a state of being, a realm of being, or the corresponding bright states of mind in a human life, either way, as a midterm goal, it's worthy of considering, you know, what role that plays. But at the time, it was, you know, it seemed quite obvious that it wasn't simply something that could be purchased. When you looked at what the Buddha taught and what he was emphasizing, what he really hammered away at for 45 years was this gradual training of practice. And for those people who really did have a wish to be reborn in heaven, then this was a practical way to go about that. And gradual training comes down to the same thing the Buddha keeps coming back to, basics. Dana, sila, bhavana. Dana, again, it's not just about giving up material things. It's not just about giving donations, etc. It's about giving up. It's about just giving up in general. You know, and we may be attached to our time. Our time is very valuable. So giving up time for other people is a big gift. It's real dana. We may be attached to our space and just making space in our life for other people. You know, is dana. Maybe attached to our attention, just giving other people attention is a great gift. Definitely we're attached to who we think we are. Giving that up is the greatest generosity. And sila, of course, just living a life of moral decency, sense of moral integrity, essential, and that creates respect, creates trust, creates good relationships with the people that we have around us in our lives. And bhavana, you know, mental cultivation, this more directly working with the mind, cultivating the mind, bringing up wholesome states of mind, whether that's in formal meditation, sitting and walking meditation, or whether that is through any action in daily life. You know, it's all bhavana. And if there is a path to heaven, then the Buddha has laid it out. And when I initially came across these teachings, I maybe had this idea that, well, it'd just be a nice smooth curve. You know, the more you practice dana and sila and bhavana, the more you start to feel peaceful and happy. You know, and it just keeps getting better and better. But for anybody who's really gotten down to start to do the work, you see that it's not quite that straightforward. Sometimes it's a bit more like a zigzag path rather than a nice straight curve. And even if our effort is sincere and continuous, there are going to be some days where we just we do feel peaceful, and other days where it's just a hard slog. You know, we're working through the karmic effects of unwholesome things that may have been done in the past, and we just have to patiently work our way through that. So the Buddha's path, rather than being a nice, straight, even path, it's a bit more like a gradually ascending zigzag path to increasingly purified consciousness. I think when I was young, there were some signs that I might end up as a monk. However, it wasn't really until I graduated from college that I started to see the writing on the wall. But, you know, I didn't want to rush into it. I wanted to be sure. Because I knew, you know, I could see even at that time that my thoughts often could be interpreted with a variety of meanings. at that time, it was mainly my experiences in nature that, you know, I would, where I would experience a sense of peace. Sitting underneath a tree, sitting by a stream, listening to the birds, you know, feeling that sense of peace. And it was at those times that I could get a sense that my thoughts were not to be totally trusted, and that even my own thoughts could be misleading, misguided. And then I began to wonder, really, well, what's it all about? And the more I started to wonder in that way, the more I started to wander. Again, at that time, looking to Western society, you know, there was a certain feeling I got, you know, looking to the West and what that symbolized, some of the, I guess as a young person out of college, it was more easy to focus on maybe some of the uninspiring values around in Western society, and take the inspiring ones for granted. But, you know, there were certain uninspiring ones that had to do with, you know, a more materialistic or superficial way of approaching life. You know, and the more I saw that, the more I looked at that, the more I wondered. And there was a certain calling in my heart. It was like my heart or my spirit was kind of calling out for leaving, even though I, you know, valued home. There was a certain calling for leaving home. And the initial stage of Buddhist ordination is called the home leaving, going forth from the home, going forth from the home life. And really all that symbolizes, you know, symbolizing the comforts of home, the predictability, the security of home, and the all the excitements, but also all the hassles, all the responsibilities, all the worldly aspirations, and then leaving that behind. So there's a certain spiritual, maybe a vague spiritual longing that we're kind of calling out for leaving home. And for some of us, that when we left home, we really left home. We left the continent, ended up a long ways from home. I remember at that time when I was considering ordination, and I'd come back home and had gradually given away pretty much everything I had, and spent time with my family. And I remember one time when my mother and I had driven down to the Big Sur coast, and we just wanted to spend some time with each other before I headed off. And we were sitting on a beach down there, and she was recording my thoughts at the time of why I wanted to go off to Thailand to ordain. I don't know whatever happened to that tape. It was it was on one of those really old-fashioned machines that had little wheels that went around. And it was recording thoughts of, you know, why would I want to leave home? you know, for the trees of the forest tradition. And although at times my thoughts were sometimes clouded by smoke, I remember the first time I read an Ajahn Chah book, and it came out in mid-80s or so. Yeah, it's been about 85 or mid-80s or so. And as soon as I read it, there was a very clear feeling of, now this is a voice of someone who really stands firm in the Dhamma, someone who really sees. And it wasn't long after that that I ended up going to Asia, and it wasn't long after that that I ended up in robes. Because when you come in contact with someone who is clearly very wise, even if it's just through a book, the contrast to the rest of what I had experienced in life was so great that, you know, it can't help to make you wonder, you know, well, what's it all about? What are we doing this for? It made me wonder. And again, the more I wondered, the further I wandered. As I traveled, there was, I don't know, there was like a quiet voice whispering, you know, not a schizophrenic voice, but sort of a, you know, the metaphor for listening to your heart, like a quiet voice whispering that, you know, if I just tuned in, then it wouldn't be all that long before the path of the Buddha, the path of the Dhamma, would start to lead my life in a reasonable direction. You know, it made sense. It was a great thing about the Dhamma. It was reasonable. It made sense. And the story of the Buddha getting enlightened at dawn, purifying his consciousness at dawn, you know, of all greed, anger, delusion, a fully purified consciousness, you know, there was a trust that for those who would follow in his footsteps, that if you had enough long-standing, patient endurance, that you'd be able to realize the same happiness, the same peace, same liberation. After all, you know, the forest masters, they laughed a lot. You know, when I did go to Thailand and was fortunate enough to have contact with called Kruba Ajahns, or forest masters, they laughed a lot. But practice itself, sometimes you just had to laugh because it was so difficult. And, you know, even in the midst of the difficulties of, you know, of really really sincerely practicing, you know, in a place like Wat Pananachat with Ajahn Pasano as the abbot, I mean, you had to practice. Otherwise, you get kicked out. It wasn't. I'm not, I promise I won't tell any old stories tonight. But, you know, you couldn't be a wimp at Wat Pananachat when Ajahn Pasano was the abbot. Practice. It's just like weeding. It's like being in a, it's like fighting your way through a hedge of gorse or barberry or blackberry. When I when I first went to the property that was later to become Vimuti Monastery in New Zealand, the lack of trees and the amount of weeds was alarming. But every spring, you know, we'd get out there and start to clean the paddocks in preparation for planting trees in May. So then weeding ended up becoming this perfect metaphor for Dhamma practice, right? And, I mean, first of all, what do you consider a weed? Well, it's a value judgment, isn't it? But basically, when it comes to plants, it tends to come down to what's indigenous, what's native, and what's not. And in Buddhist practice, it comes down to wholesome or unwholesome states of mind, you know. And then really look, well, what is the Buddha's definition of wholesome and unwholesome? Not our own definition. Because it's so easy to fool ourselves. And even if we, you know, we know what the weeds are according to the book, actually seeing the weeds is not that easy. People who were new to the monastery would say, okay, well, you know, I'd take them to a patch of you know, places. It's full of ragwort and thistles and blackberry, and say, okay, well, you want to do some weeding around here? And they're like, I don't see any weeds. It's good to me. And it's like, well, it's just like our minds, you know. We come to the Dhamma practice, like, yeah, greed, hatred, delusion. Don't see much of, don't see many defilements here. You know, and the other people who have a bit more experience in the monastery are like, this guy is like totally full of greed, hatred, and delusion. But for us to see our own weeds, it takes a refinement of perception. For better or worse, you know, I can walk around the land. I just kind of sweep over the hills of the paddock, and I see 5 thistles, 3 ragwort, and a couple of gorse that are coming up. Just because perception has been refined along that particular area. And other people, they look and they don't see anything. I have to kind of take them and point. But our minds are the same way. Right. You know, if we want to keep taking the practice deeper and deeper and really cleaning out the paddocks of our own mind, then it takes this constant refining of perception. Now, where am I holding on? Where is their attachment? Where is their desire? What types of desire are manifesting in my life? You know, where is their aversion? Where am I holding on? What am I clinging to? In what ways do my sense of self manifest? And these are all weeds, and they're coming up all the time. But often it just takes a refinement of perception to be able to see them in the first place. And then it takes a huge amount of persistence. I mean, for any lay people who have stayed at our monastery, then they know what I mean. It takes a tremendous amount of persistence just to stay with the task at hand, because it can seem overwhelming. I mean, there were, when I first arrived at the property, whole entire valleys and hillsides were just covered in weeds. It would just be yellow with ragwort or thistles or whatever. And it could seem hopeless, it could seem endless, just overwhelming. And yet, with a sense of gradual persistence, not giving up, just doing as much as we can. Now, you know, there are those whole areas, those whole same areas are 95% clean, 99% clean in most areas. And then occasionally there's one that comes up and you know, maintain it. But whole areas that used to be full of defilements are now clean. So no matter how many weeds we have, no matter how overwhelming it can seem, it's just a matter of sticking with it. But then the really tricky thing about weeds is that they come back. You know, you work really hard, this whole field's just absolutely clean, there's not a single thistle, ragwort, solanium, deadly nightshade, barberry, gorse, or blackberry in this whole field. It's absolutely clean. And then next year, or even sometimes a few months later, they start popping up again. And you can't just ignore it when they pop up again, because if there's some roots left, then they're going to come back. And one thistle can have 1,000 seeds. And then it starts to spread again. And then you get the same thing happening in your mind. Do a lot of practice, maybe for many years. Things are looking pretty clean. And then we start to get complacent. A few weeds start popping up. Weeds with seeds, if you don't get all the roots, then they grow back. Now, of course, there's always two paths we can choose. You know, path of Dhamma, the path of the world, path of weeds, or the path of no weeds. And sometimes we're just alternating between the two. But no matter how much we've been sucked into the ways of the world, no matter how often we get fooled, we buy into more worldly aspirations, or ways of looking at ourselves, it's never too late to change the path that we're on. But you don't want to wait too long. Because eventually you just start to wonder, well, what's the point? What's the point of what we're doing? In the big picture, really, what's the point? And you can't help but wonder. But sometimes, the seeds have been planted and we don't know. But already, the Buddha's example has been calling for us to join, walk in his footsteps. Dana, sila, bhavana. You know, with bhavana, like if you close your eyes, can you hear the wind element? Can you hear the wind element of the breath coming into your body and flowing out of your body? And did you know that even though with all of the myriad meditation techniques that people can have some very strong opinions about, it was simply watching the wind element that led Buddha to his final enlightenment. paying close attention to the wind element, air flowing in, flowing out, led to deeper and deeper states of peace. But then, in addition to that, focusing on the insight aspect of the breath, in the end, everything in the universe is just like a breath that arises, comes, and it goes, passes. So the entire path of the Buddha actually just rested on the wind. This whole gradually ascending, zigzag path of increasingly purified consciousness, just resting on the wind element. As we gradually make our way down this path, then there are times where the more shadow side of our life can seem even larger than our more noble aspirations. But in the end, it really always comes down to a sense of self and non-self, soul, non-soul, and then all of the weeds that arise from that, all of the sufferings that can arise from that, all of the misunderstandings that can arise from that. So you have to trust in this knowing, this sense of whatever arises, this quality of knowing. So that which knows what? Well, just knowing, understanding, quality of wisdom that, you know, whatever happens or whatever is happening, that if it's encompassed with a larger spaciousness of simply knowing, understanding, watching, this will help to lead towards taking the appropriate action, making right effort. And the sense of knowing will gradually lead on to a brighter and brighter mind. Generally, in meditation, when the mind becomes more peaceful, body becomes more light, and the internal field of vision can also start to become very bright. And for a long time, the best advice is simply to ignore it. It is a byproduct of meditation, byproduct of the mind becoming a bit more peaceful. But it's important to just keep our attention unwaveringly on the meditation object, whether that's the breath, for example. Just unwaveringly stay with the breath and not to take the attention off of that. But at some point, the breath can become so refined and the brightness can become so dominant in our consciousness, just like this bright white light. And it's at that point, then one can switch and actually take that as a meditation object. And then that can kind of lead on or show a way into even deeper states of peace. And at those times, then this sense that everything that it's experienced is gold, because the mind rises up to a certain golden quality, and then what we experience from that, kind of transform the world. But if we're willing to listen or pay attention very, very closely, then the truth of the way things are gradually does become apparent. And at first this can manifest as a bit more like feeling unified with things, especially with deeper states of peace or samadhi where the mind come together. Then that can correspondingly lead to a sense of unity with things, or all things being one, kind of being one with all. A bit of a mystical, you know, sense about that. And even though this can feel quite profound, and it is, the Buddha didn't consider even this, these levels of kind of profound unity to be the final realization or the final releasing or purification of consciousness, full enlightenment and nibbana. There's a simile that was common in the forest tradition. I think Lumpa Cha used it as well. That if you've developed very good samadhi, you know, deep peace of mind, it's like a big rock that, you know, it's solid. And the ground on which that rock sits, it's impossible for any weeds to grow. But if you can roll that rock, then it's not too long before the weeds start to grow in that same place. And so in that sense, it's only a short-term refuge. It's not a long-term refuge. But a mind which is released both through developing that peace, but also insight, you know, both samadhi and wisdom, calm and insight, then that becomes not just a rock or a boulder, but it becomes like a mountain, a solid rock. Unshakable. Like it says in the Sutta Nipata, for one who has cut off delusion or uprooted delusion, then one is like a mountain, a solid rock, imperturbable. No weeds growing, no possibility of weeds coming back. And the path up this mountain, this gradually ascending zigzag path to increasingly purified consciousness, that's a path that no amount of money or donations can buy. So I offer this for your reflection this evening.
Anvayam Gampitaya Sarukram Dramase
Sadhu, 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 Anubodhami.
You think they got the hidden message? I don't know, it might have been a bit too obscure. I don't know, I think it went down like a lead balloon. Like a really big balloon.